There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time, which means that today we are talking about Roy Moore. I promise you I will not be using any of the salacious details of the allegations, and so I would not suggest to you that anything we're going to talk about today is going to be particularly inappropriate for all listeners. How do we bring God back into conversations that people are having today about abuse? How do we bring God back into conversations happening today where Jesus and the earthly parentage of Jesus is brought into a conversation about, I don't know, substantiating or giving a pass to potential molestation? I got to tell you, this is a complicated story about Roy Moore, and we are going to dig around in it today. The goal is to help you become a conversant ambassador of Jesus Christ, to speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day. We're not particularly trying to equip you to be either red or blue in these conversations. We're trying to equip you to be Christian, distinctively Christian, in the conversations of the day. So I invite you to connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our email newsletter. It has got lots of information and commentary we don't have time to share here in this hour on the air. I can also tell you that it includes this week the interview that we are going to air right after the break today. And it's one that you are going to want to have a record of and a transcript of. And so that is going to be included in the email from reconnectwithcarmen.com today. All right, friends, you can also always like The Reconnect on Facebook, and you can let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. I have been particularly active on Twitter today as this Roy Moore story has been unfolding. Let me start off with one item of really good news from Capitol Hill. We talked yesterday during the show about the need for the restoration of the adoption tax credit to the tax reform plan, and it happened. Now, it actually happened, unbeknownst to me, while we were talking about it. So there you go. We have good news for us on that front. Here is a little excerpt of the conversation about that from the National Review. A tax credit for adoptive families has been retained in both the House and Senate GOP tax bills following pushback from socially conservative lawmakers and anti-abortion groups. We like to call those pro-life groups. The credit was initially removed in the House version of the legislation, but an amendment released Thursday from the Ways and Means Committee, Chairman Kevin Brady, Republican from Texas, retained it. Preserving the credit, quote, will ensure that parents can continue to receive additional tax relief as they open their hearts and their homes to an adopted child, Brady said Thursday during the fourth day of the committee markup. So just as we do our best to call out mistakes when we see them, we also want to give praise when praise is due and when wisdom is demonstrated. We certainly want to applaud each and every one of those members of Congress who was a part of restoring the adoption tax credit to the tax reform plan in both its Senate and House forms. All right, friends, now to the story that is literally leading every news outlet around the country. There is a candidate for U.S. Senate in Alabama. We actually talked about him during the primary process, in which he defeated Luther Strange, who is currently in the Senate fulfilling the unexpired term of Jeff Sessions, who was elevated from his Senate post to a post in the president's cabinet. He is now our attorney general. So there are now allegations against Roy Moore. Again, he's a candidate for the U.S. Senate in the state of Alabama. There are now allegations brought by four different women who have come forward to claim that decades ago, when he was in his 30s and they were mere teenagers, and he was a prosecutor in Etowah County, Alabama, that in some cases he made what I would describe as inappropriate advances to girls between 16 and 18 years old. But in the most serious of the allegations or accusations coming from a woman who was at the time only 14, I will describe that as at least sexual assault, if not just outright sexual assault. I mean, that's what I would call it. So conservatives are encouraged, I think, to be careful here. You will hear lots of conservatives just outright dismissing the claims, siding with Roy Moore, who is vigorously denying the accusations. He is claiming that it's fake news. He's claiming that it's a desperate political attack by the Democratic Party and by the Washington Post. I think we need to pause, and we need to be careful and not too quickly dismiss the claims. When we were certainly not dismissive of claims of women brought against a liberal ideologue named Harvey Weinstein, we were willing to accept those women's testimony on the face of it, and yet somehow we are not willing to accept the testimony of these women on the face of it, and I think that is a problem. I certainly don't know if the allegations are true. We certainly should be troubled on a number of fronts. First of all, it's notable that these women did not seek out the press. The press sought them out after hearing rumors from other folks that there were these accusations, these stories out there. Second, if you actually take the time to read the report, and it's in the Washington Post, and the headline is, "Woman says Roy Moore initiated sexual encounter when she was 14. He was 32. So that's the Washington Post investigative report that got all of this going. The woman's name is Lee Korfman. And if you read the report, it includes validation from a number of witnesses who say that they were aware of these stories. It's not as if these are stories that these women made up in recent days. These are conversations that they had with trusted friends over the course of many years, and that certainly bolsters their credibility. And then there is this reality that the youngest of the accusers, when she offers her explanation for not coming forward, it rings true. I just got to tell you, when she offers her explanation for why she didn't come forward at any point in time along the way in the last 30 plus years, it rings true. She actually told the Washington Post, quote, "She did not share her story about Moore, partly because of the trouble in her life. She has had three divorces and financial problems." Friends, this is a sad truth. This is an honest reality. Sexual abuse of a child, these kinds of traumatic introductions to sexual realities have catastrophic effects throughout the course of a person's life. For the offender, it's a once and done thing. For the child, it is a trauma they never outlive. She told reporters, "I felt like I had done something bad. It kind of set the course for me doing other things that were bad." That is sadly often the case. These kinds of experiences set a trend line in a person's life. It actually sets them up to be abused by others along the way. It weakens them. So in the words of David French in the National Review, in his post on this subject, he says this: "We seem to be in the midst of a unique and important national moment. Each day seems to bring a new story of yet another powerful person facing a string of accusations. While there is the danger of a witch hunt, the presence of multiple claims of misconduct from multiple sources should always make us pause. Regardless of whether the alleged abuser comes from the left or the right, it's a moral imperative that we did not determine the veracity of the allegations by the ideology of the accused." Talking here in terms of the ideology of the accused, when we're talking about Roy Moore, we're talking about a person who certainly views himself and has been seen by others as a conservative Christian. That's actually the language that he uses in his own defense. I just need to say this. When we're talking about this particular story, I want to pause for a moment and I want to say this. She was 14. 14. I don't frankly think any other information is particularly necessary. For those of you arguing that there is a due process that is in order, This is actually not about someone being considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law, because there's no criminal charge here. This is about the innocence of a 14-year-old girl taken from her more than 30 years ago, and her life since has been marked every moment by it. We have talked here on this program, on The Reconnect, with victims of sexual violence and sexual abuse. We have talked here on this program about the trauma created in the lives of young women by powerful men. And if you have ever known a young woman who has been lured into a relationship by a man and groomed for sexual contact and suffered the loss of her innocence, and sometimes a great deal more, then you know why these women did not come forward as Roy Moore ascended higher and higher and higher in terms of the ranks of power and influence. So my first inclination in this particular case is to believe the victims. One of the particular challenges for Mr. Moore along the way may be the measure by which he has judged others will now be used to judge him. You'll have to remember, this is a man who for many years served as a judge. Why harp on this subject, and why talk about this at such length? Well, because others are bringing God into this conversation in ways that are frankly not helpful, and in ways that are, one of them I would just say just flat out heretical. So God is bringing, God is being brought into this conversation by Moore's defenders. Moore's defenders include influential leaders of Christian institutions. Moore's defenders include some members of the GOP. Moore's defenders include members of his own family. In fact, let me highlight here a few things that his brother said. Jerry Moore firmly denied the charges against his brother, analogized is probably the word they mean there, his brother's situation to the persecution of Jesus Christ. That's right. This is from CNN. CNN reports that Jerry Moore said, quote, he knows the allegations against Roy Moore are not true, not true at all. The younger Moore also said, quote, he's very concerned about what the impact is going to be on their 91-year-old mother hearing all of this. They worry about her age and her health. Well, they need to be worrying about the young women. They need to be worrying about the lives that are affected in concentric circles of rippling trauma that redound from any kind of sexual abuse of a minor. Moore also claimed that the Democratic Party was behind what he called, quote, false allegations, and that, quote, these women are going to have to answer to God for these false allegations. Yes, indeed, sir, there is going to be a reckoning before God about these things. And I got to tell you, I don't think it is, I don't think that any of us should be wielding scripture as a weapon in conversations where, frankly, a very, very limited number of people know the truth. So truth is that which accords with reality. Truth is that which accords with what actually happened, not what someone would like to forget about what happened, not even about what someone maybe wishes had never happened, but truth accords with what actually happened. It doesn't really matter what you believe. It matters what is. Roy Moore, in his own defense on this, said the forces of evil, he's describing here the Obama-Clinton machine, his words not mine, and their liberal media lapdogs, his words not mine, are he describes them as the forces of evil, willing to lie, cheat, steal, and even inflict physical harm if they believe it will silence and shut up Christian conservatives like you and me. Mr. Moore, please leave Jesus out of this. Please do not continue suggesting to anyone that you are a Christian conservative until, sir, you have satisfactorily convinced us that what these women say happened many years ago did not, in fact, happen. Yes, sir, that's right. It's now upon you to demonstrate that these stories aren't true. Now, I know that's a hard row to hoe, but you, sir, have placed yourself in a position by the books you have written and the things that you have publicly said You have suggested that you are above reproach, beyond reproach. And so, sir, we now need you to demonstrate that that's true. One place that I can have you turn for some help and assistance in terms of how you can know what to say and frankly, how you can know what not to say in relationship to these issues. Ed Stetzer has an excellent blog posted at The Exchange on Christianity Today. I feel very confident sending you to read what he has to say. The title is this: Christians Don't Use Joseph and Mary to Explain Child Molesting Accusations. That's right. It's not only ridiculous, it's blasphemous. Now you're saying to yourself, What are you talking about? Joseph and Mary are being used to explain molesting accusations? Yes, friends, that's actually exactly what's going on. We recognize that these are that the allegations that have been made made by a woman who was 14 at the time. Well, one of Roy Moore's defenders thought that he would say, well, you know what? This is analogous to Jesus being born to Mary and Joseph. Mary, after all, was a teenager at the time and Joseph an adult. Okay, let's just hold it right there, people. How little information are you operating with if you think that's the Christmas story? How little information are you operating with if you think that the story that is lifted up in the Gospels, the story of Jesus's conception and birth, is a story about adolescent molestation by Joseph? I mean, seriously, how... You were in a bad Sunday school class, and you need to open up your Bible and you need to actually read it. If that is even for a moment the sick, twisted interpretation that you have come away with in terms of what Scripture has to say about the incarnation of Jesus the Christ. Now, I might sound hot about it. Ed Stetzer's even a little bit hotter. He says his supporters, he's talking about Roy Moore, his supporters have actually become some of the news here. Some of them stunningly appealing to religious reasons. He lifts up a few examples. He says Alabama Marion County GOP chairman David Hall told a reporter, quote, it was 40 years ago. I really don't see the relevance of it. He was 32. She was supposedly 14. She's not saying that anything happened other than they kissed. It wouldn't affect whether or not I'd vote for him. Okay, just stop right there. Are you kidding me? First of all, that's not all she's saying happened. And this notion that he is substantiating that that Roy Moore was 32 and yet qualifying that she was, quote, supposedly 14, immediately suggests he does not believe that she's even telling the truth about her age at the time. And Mr. Hall, it wasn't only that they kissed. It was that he put her in his car and he drove her into the woods to a secluded cabin. And because there may be young listening ears, I won't go into what went on beyond that, but they did a whole lot more than kiss, according to the allegations. So nowhere in here, first of all, let it be clear, does Mr. Hall, the Alabama Marion County GOP chairman, never in here does he suggest that nothing happened. He's actually willing to say, it's okay with me if these things did happen 40 years ago between a 32-year-old man who was an attorney and a 14-year-old girl, who, by the way, he met in the hallway of the court knowing that her parents were in a custody battle, knowing that she was weak, knowing that she was vulnerable, knowing that she was living alone with her mom, taking advantage of each and every one of those vulnerabilities. The most widely reported comment came from Alabama State auditor, Jim Ziegler. He told the Washington Examiner, this is the Joseph and Mary quote, so brace yourself. If you're driving, put both hands on the wheel and slow down a little and use your mirrors, because this one will make you swerve into oncoming traffic, so please don't do that. The Alabama State auditor, Jim Ziegler, actually told the Washington Examiner, quote, take Joseph and Mary. Mary was a teenager. Joseph was an adult carpenter. They became the parents of Jesus. There's just nothing immoral or illegal here. Maybe just a little bit unusual. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Sir, first of all, that is a gross misrepresentation of the story of the coming together of Mary and Joseph, who, by the way, had no relations, very explicitly in the scriptures. Jesus conceived by the power of the Holy Spirit in the Virgin Mary. Scriptures very clearly say they had no relations until after they were married, until after the birth of Jesus. Scripture also is really very, very clear here that that we're not talking about an issue of sexual molestation when Joseph eventually does take Mary as his wife. Let's be clear. No evangelical believer believes this about Mary and Joseph. What we're talking about here in this particular story is a 32-year-old prosecuting attorney accused of molesting a 14-year-old girl. To liken that unto Joseph and Mary, in the words of Ed Stetzer, is both ridiculous and blasphemous. He says, even those who followed ancient marriage customs, which we would not follow today, certainly knew the difference between molesting and marriage. So here's some of the concern that I have. We have people representing themselves as Christians who clearly are not. We have people representing themselves as evangelicals who clearly are not. We have people who are representing the Bible to say and attest to things that it clearly does not. Christians do not use Mary and Joseph to explain child molestation accusations. Furthermore, I think it's important. This Alabama state auditor, he actually presumes that it all happened. He actually presumes the story is true. He presumes that, in fact, Roy Moore, as a 32-year-old prosecuting attorney, in fact, did have this kind of relationship with a 14-year-old. He just doesn't see anything wrong with it. I had a conversation with my sister just before we went on the air. She works in the financial industry. In the financial industry, they're still talking about Harvey Weinstein. They're still talking about the fallout related to all of that. I don't know that in the meeting that she was in San Francisco, the Roy Moore story even made it all that way out there yet. Nor would it be well understood in terms of the context of Southern evangelicalism. But she did say this, and I thought that this was interesting and profound. She said, it's interesting that the sexual harassment, you know, if you were to ask a group of women in business who are our age, in their early 50s, have you ever been sexually harassed in your field? Every hand in the room would go up. We've all experienced it. It doesn't matter if you are in ministry or if you are in the financial industry, in higher education, or Hollywood or politics. If you're a woman and you're in your 50s or up, you've been sexually harassed. It's a reality of the world we have lived in. It's also become illegal and sidelined largely in the business community. The business community has largely cleaned up its act in this area, except maybe for Silicon Valley, who's now getting to learn something about it. But in higher education, it's still a problem. In the church, it's still a problem. In Hollywood, it's clearly still a problem. In politics, it's still a problem. And so there is a lot more conversation yet to be had on this subject matter. And the reality is, those of you who want to deny that these allegations are true because they took place 40 years ago, I got a little wake-up call for you. The Me Too movement is just getting started. It, in fact, doesn't matter what you believe about the veracity of a person's story. It matters what the truth is. And that truth is that which aligns with reality. And the reality is these women are remembering events. Judge Roy Moore may have honestly forgotten. His ability to rationalize them away is pretty powerful. But if they happened, they happened. And, you know, there may be hell to pay. That may be the best way I can put it. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. It is a listener-supported ministry by people just like you. Log on to reconnectwithcarmen.com. During the break, let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. When we come back, I am going to be having a conversation with Evan Owens about reboot recovery, how we can get trauma recovery help to our veterans on this Veterans Day. This is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen. We'll be right back. Hey friends, welcome back. This is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We are seeking to put God in his place back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about, which means today we are talking all about veterans. We're seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. And on this Veterans Day, we're privileged to have with us Evan Owens. Evan is the executive director of Reboot Combat Recovery. Reboot is all capitalized. It's combat trauma healing course designed to make a lasting difference in the lives of service members and their families. He's based out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, home of the 101st Airborne Division. So through Reboot Combat Recovery, combat veterans and their families are experiencing all kinds of healing related to PTSD. And so we want to talk with Evan today about the reality of vets returning home and how we can come alongside them in their recovery process. You can check it all out at rebootrecovery.com, and you can follow them on Twitter at rebootrecovery. Evan, welcome to The Reconnect.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
All right. So describe for us, I think that when we think about veterans, you know, each one of us, our minds probably go to the one veteran who we know, and we think that is the average veteran. But maybe help us understand sort of what the average veteran is like when they leave military service and return to civilian life, and then what that transition is like for them.
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of times we tend to compare generations. We say, well, World War II was the greatest, and this generation has struggles and all this sort of thing. I think the reality is that only 0.43% of the eligible population served in this war, and yet it's been going on, 17 years now, so it makes it the longest war in U.S. history. So we have a smaller group of people serving longer and deploying more than ever. And so you combine all of those factors, and it's creating situations where a lot of spouses and kids have grown up in homes where it's natural for one of the parents to have been gone more than actually be at home. And those dynamics, along with the traumas and the horrific things that sometimes you encounter during combat, have really combined to make a pretty complex situation for a lot of people when they come back.
Well, there's just a lot of folks who live in places and parts of the country and maybe whose family systems and social systems just don't include veterans. And so, you know, I happen to be in a family where we have military veterans, and I live in a community where there are lots of veterans, but that's just not true in some places across the country. So can you just describe for us when a person returns from, let's say, you know, multiple deployments, they've served for a long period of time, and they're trying to return to civilian life in a community where they're just misunderstood. Talk with us about the kinds of stresses that they're experiencing upon return.
Yeah, I mean, you know, transitional wellness is a broad category. There's lots of factors that go into it. Specifically, the area that we focus in is trauma sustained from combat. Now, there's job placement, there's marriage issues, there's financial issues. All those things compound to really create some complex issues. And when you talk about a term that many people are seeing in the media is post-traumatic stress, right? We all hear that term. And I think if you go back, you know, World War II and before that, physical wounds was really all we paid attention to. Once Vietnam happened, now we paid attention to mental health associated with war. So we said, okay, the mind and the body can be wounded. But then really we began asking the question, well, if it's possible for your mind and body to be wounded, can your soul be wounded as well? And that's really what Reboot focuses on, is if you're experiencing trauma has led to struggles in transition, struggles getting your home life back under control, struggles in trying to find your place and your kind of your purpose now that maybe your time in the military is ending, or maybe it's even going to continue in a different segment, we're going to help kind of transition through those steps to heal.
Okay, so unpack the term for us. What, I mean, we hear it a lot, as you've mentioned, but tell us exactly what is post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yeah, I mean, the most kind of generic definition is experiencing or witnessing a horrific event, or even participating in one, and the trauma that's sustained. A lot of times you're going to see manifestations of symptoms following that, and some of them are physical, things like nightmares, anxiety, depression, those types of symptoms. But you're also going to have some other things where a lot of times we believe that trauma can wound kind of our roots, if you will, and those things manifest in different ways where we can't control our emotions anymore. Maybe we're really angry when we shouldn't be. Maybe we start to lean on substances to try to help us kind of regulate and manage some of our emotions. Or maybe we used to be able to be good at relationships and we used to kind of be the life of the party, but now suddenly we kind of find ourselves isolating and pulling away from the people who may be the ones who could help us the most. And all of those things kind of fall under the broad umbrella of post-traumatic stress.
Okay, friends, we're talking to Evan Owens. He's the executive director of Reboot Combat Recovery. You can check it out at rebootrecovery.com. You can follow them on Twitter at Reboot Recovery. Evan, describe to us how you guys at Reboot Recovery help restore people's souls. I mean, we're talking about soul wounds. So what are some of the things that you do?
I'm so glad you asked that. Yeah, so there's a couple of factors. When we talk about soul wounds, really what we're talking about is the fact that we're not in the business of reducing or removing symptoms, that we believe that God never wastes a wound, and that sometimes we can actually use symptoms to push us or to propel us into new things, new purposes and destinies that maybe even without those hardships we wouldn't have been pushed into. Look at these root issues, and we say that, you know, we can promise that you can live a life full of purpose and joy in spite of those symptoms. And so we work hand to hand with mental and physical wellness programs to say, let them focus on the fruit, if you will, the symptoms, and we're going to dig down and help them focus on the roots, which is more about how are we responding to that trauma. So for example, someone makes a decision and now one of my friends was killed in combat. I could be mad at the enemy. I could be mad at chain of command. I could be mad at the whole situation. And all of that could create in me sort of bitterness, and that bitterness could create anger. So instead of approaching it from saying, okay, you're experiencing anger symptoms, let's put you in anger management, let's try to get you medication around that, we're going to instead say, well, let's actually work on developing a heart of forgiveness for yourself and for others, and how do you really practice a life of forgiving others and those around you. And that's going to in and of itself deliver freedom. And so that's just one example. So all of our courses are 12 weeks long. They're all led by veterans or spouses. So they're peer led, and all of our courses provide meals and childcare. So the whole family goes through it together.
All right. And if there's a veteran listening right now, what's the fastest way, or a veteran family, what's the fastest way for them to directly connect with you guys?
Yeah, our website, they can actually register just to join a group at rebootrecovery.com/join, and they'll be able to find a location. We've got, you know, just under 100 locations in like 26 states around the country. So chances are, if they're hurting, they're going to walk into a room full of people who have gone through or who are going through some of the same exact struggles that they're going through right now. And I quickly will add this, if I may, is if there's church leaders listening or people listening who would be interested in starting a group, they can go to the same website and get information on how they could deploy hope in their own community.
Well, what would that look like? Because I think that we tend to have a lot of ministry leaders who are listening. So describe for us what that would look like for a ministry leader who reaches out and says, okay, this turns my heart. Like, I know I've got families who are suffering from PTSD. They need recovery. They need hope. I have no idea how to even enter into these conversations or start, but I know I need help. Do they call you? They reach out to you through the website, and you'll actually help them do a program in their own environment?
That's exactly right. So we talk to dozens of people every day that are in that exact situation. They have the will to help, but maybe they don't have a clear way to do it, because helping veterans is a little bit more complicated than, say, you know, some other generic kind of spiritual issue. And so really what we're going to give them is an entire kit, complete with leadership training. It's going to help them develop an outreach strategy to reach military people. We're going to give them curriculum for the course and for their participants. We're even going to give them Facebook social media ads and graphics that they can run to reach out to people. Finding churches are a great place for many veterans to belong, and many active duty people to belong and reconnect with other people who have gone through similar things. And so we love empowering the local church to do this.
All right. Again, folks, the website is rebootrecovery.com. My guest is Evan Owens. Evan, talk with us a little bit about survivor's guilt and the need for self-forgiveness and the power that's found there.
Yeah, you know, I'd say false guilt, survivor's guilt, those are some of the biggest things that we struggle with people, that we kind of work through with people. You know, there's an element, I think, that's true. The best lies contain an element of the truth. And so what happens a lot of times, especially downrange, is people see a circumstance and they begin to fill their mind with should'ves and would'ves and if I could'ves. And all those sort of sentiments are great in hindsight, but in the fact of the moment is you did probably what your body was trained and what you were trained through the military to do. And so one of the things we do is actually help them realize that there's sort of this framework they can overlay over their experiences and begin to say, is the guilt I'm feeling, you know, godly sorrow, like it talks about in 1 Corinthians, or is it really a false guilt? And when we look at false guilt, survivor's guilt is one of those catch-22 guilt, you know, where there wasn't a win-win is another type. There's, you know, 10 or 12 different types of false guilt traps that the enemy can set up for people. And they're so easy. They're so easy for us all to fall into. And having someone be able to point out the truth in that can say, like, well, that's not real. And it's sort of this aha moment of, wow, you're right. I've been doing time for a crime that I didn't commit.
Well, I have a veteran in my family who I am absolutely going to email right after the show and say, all right, you got to see if there's one of these in your area. And if not, you got to figure out how to connect with these guys. Again, folks, the ministry is Reboot Recovery. It's Reboot Combat Recovery. The website is rebootrecovery.com. Let's spend a couple of minutes, Evan, talking about veteran suicide. What are the stats and what can people do maybe to see the signs of depression that lead to it or how to connect their loved ones with the help they need?
That's a great question. I'm really glad you asked that. So the stat currently is over 20 veterans a day still die by suicide. That number's down from 22 a couple of years ago, which is good. That means us and other great organizations are making a difference. But I'll say this quickly, which is now more than ever, people of faith have a voice in this conversation about suicide. And the reason is that trauma catalyzes a conversation about faith. When you go through something devastating, one of our first human reactions is, if there's a God, why didn't he do something? And that's something that the mental health world can't answer. And so as church members, the first thing we can do is we can be present and not be afraid of conversations about trauma, but actually approach confidently conversations about trauma. The second thing is to, if you feel someone might be suicidal, it is a time for you to feel very strong and courageous and ask them a very straightforward question, which is, you know, are you feeling or are you planning some form of suicide? And that puts people in a situation where it's really uncomfortable. I've had those situations. But what's the other alternative? To not ask boldly enough to skirt around the issue and say later, well, I just thought they were going to be fine. And so this is the best thing you can do is if you feel like that's a possibility. The other thing is if a family member comes to you saying, you know, my spouse is suicidal, bring in experts, call a Reboot leader, call a suicide hotline if it's urgent and sort of triage that issue. There's some great online numbers you can Google for that and find four or five right at the top of the listing. And so, yeah, that's an issue that not to undervalue being direct and asking point blank.
So, Evan, first of all, thank you for being so gracious with your time today. I feel like so when you say trauma catalyzes a conversation about faith, we as a culture seem to be experiencing a preponderance of these just horrific events that are like battlefields. I mean, in terms of what people are actually witnessing and then what all of us are witnessing via media and social media. I'm thinking about Las Vegas. I'm thinking about the New York bike path. I'm thinking about Sutherland Springs, Texas. We're talking about scenes and events that are normally experienced only on, only in the context of war, only in battlefields. Talk with us for a moment about what Christian leaders in churches everywhere need to know in terms of encountering everyday people who are now either witnessing or experiencing firsthand these kinds of traumas.
Yeah, it's funny. My wife and I were just talking about that this morning. And, you know, it's interesting. In January, we're launching a new program called First Line Recovery, and it's for first responders and their families, which is just complimentary to Reboot, right? But it still raises the question, what about just the average kind of Tom civilian who just goes to church one morning or is walking down the street in New York one day and this happens? And I think that it's exciting to me to see the number of churches that are stepping forward and saying we want to be part of this conversation. We want to be part of it. And I think that we're seeing that in a few different ways. I think one, we're starting to see where we're not deferring everything just to mental health experts. Yes, there's a very important place for mental health. We deeply value it. But there's also a very important place for spiritual well-being as well. So I think the first thing is we have to engage in the conversation and create safe places for people to be vulnerable and open and to challenge and question their faith and ask those really tough questions. Number two is we have to avoid pat answers. We have to be willing to let them sort of process through those things and just kind of ask questions and encourage them in that. And the third thing, really, I would say that we see the most in trauma would be reminding them what character is in spite of what they're seeing. Reminding them of all the times we have seen God do things, both throughout Bible and throughout modern times, and really reinforcing the character and the heart of God in spite of the fact that we live in a fallen world where tragedy is happening all around us. And so we tend to, as human beings, blame God when things go bad. And so in essence, we're pushing away the one who can help us the most. And so we constantly encourage church pastors, lay people, to remind them that when sin enters the world, that it's terrible, but that trauma is done to us, but also sin is done by us as human beings. And that's the source of evil, that sin is to blame, not God. God is your ally, not your enemy.
Man, I hope you're ready to scale up, because 100 groups across the country is not going to be enough for Reboot Recovery. And once you launch First Line Recovery in January and everybody catches wind of the fact that churches can be equipped through these programs to actually reach traumatized people in the culture at large, man, we're just going to pray a tenfold blessing upon what you're doing and the expansion of this ministry. Thank you so much for everything that you're doing. Again, friends, the website is rebootrecovery.com. If you want to join, just hit /join. If you want more information about how you and your church can step forward and be equipped, not deferring to others, but actually engaging in this conversation about recovery from trauma, both for those who have been on the battlefield through Reboot Recovery, but also if you wanted to be a part of First Line Recovery launching in January. These are the guys to reach out to. Evan Owens, thank you so much for joining us today on the Reconnect.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
All right, friends, this is Veterans Day. And there are 1.3 million men and women on active duty in the U.S. military today. Nearly a 500,000 of them are deployed currently overseas. On this Veterans Day, we want to recognize those who have served. And we also want to be grateful and thankful for those who are serving today. Want to just read off to you the places around the world where U.S. military personnel are currently deployed. And you can be sending up prayers as we are elevating these places in our minds. So praying and thankful today for U.S. military personnel in Iraq, in Syria, Afghanistan, Somalia, South Sudan, Norway, Poland, the Ukraine, Estonia, Bulgaria, and Kuwait. And additionally, the U.S. Naval Fleet has ships currently off the coast of the Korean Peninsula and Japan, in the waters off Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Israel, and in the Black Sea. Let me ask this. Do you know a member of the U.S. military? Like, that's a good question for us to be asking ourselves today. Do I know a veteran? Good question for today. But do I know any active duty military personnel? John Kerry, the White House Chief of Staff, said recently about U.S. service members, quote, "Most of you as Americans don't know them. Many of you don't know anyone who knows any one of them." What John Kelly is talking about there is the reality that the military tends to be populated, at least in recent decades, by people from a concentrated portion of the country, from particular states and even particular communities, and then veterans tend to choose to live in certain places in the country when they leave active duty service. And so, I have a little research to share with you, because I thought that it's kind of interesting to look at. There's an annual report on population representation in the military service. And I thought that it would be just interesting for us to recognize that there are different periods of time in which the military is more dispersed or, you know, representative of all states across the country. And then there are times like we live in now where we have been in a post-draft situation for an entire generation. And so you want to say to yourself, well, the draft is not something we want to return to. But it has meant that since the end of the draft, More and more members of the U.S. military come from a smaller and smaller number of states. So when John Kelly says most of you as Americans don't know an active duty member of the U.S. military, and many of you don't know anyone who knows any one of them, he's probably about right. Active duty military now make up just 0.4% of the U.S. population. So in 1968, 1.8% of the population was serving in the military actively. And so obviously more people knew more people in the military. And certainly everybody knew somebody who knew somebody in the military. If you go all the way back to 1945, nearly 9% of the American population was serving in the U.S. military. There was literally not a community that wasn't touched by military service. But now we are looking at enlistments that come from really a fairly small number of states, and so you can look at states, particularly in the Southeast. The state of Georgia actually has the highest enlistment rate of any state in the Union, and then it's followed by Florida, South Carolina, Virginia, Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, Alabama, Maine, and Missouri. And you say, all right, Maine looks like the outlier there. And I would say, well, you're probably right. Maine does kind of look like the outlier. And that gets us into the socioeconomic conversation, which we'll return to in just a moment. States with the lowest enlistment rates, these might also not surprise you. The District of Columbia, North Dakota, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New York, Utah, New Jersey, Vermont, Minnesota, and Pennsylvania. And so we're talking about some very large states with some very low enlistment rates in terms of, let's say, Pennsylvania, for example, or New York State. And so the northeastern states are not places where a lot of people voluntarily enlist in the military, whereas in terms of the southeastern United States, a much higher percentage of the population. So in terms of where veterans choose to live when they leave active duty, number one on the list is Alaska. 12.2% of the state's 18 and older population are actually veterans. Just think about that for just a second. 12.2% of Alaska's population are former service members. That's pretty extraordinary. Followed by Colorado, Hawaii, Montana, and Wyoming. Presumably for the same reasons that people want to go to Alaska. As one veteran put it, you come to get away from everything, especially if you've seen stuff you don't want to remember. So Maine, we said, kind of looked like the outlier in terms of why people join the military from certain places, and Maine is certainly not in the Southeast, but Maine does have a socioeconomic similarity with some of the states in the Southeast that tend to send a higher proportion of their young people into military service. And this gets to the socioeconomic conversation. The U.S. military recruitment draws disproportionately on what are described as upper lower classes and lower middle classes. And service in the U.S. military takes people from what's called this broad middle of the income spectrum, lower or upper lower class and lower middle class. So they call that the broad middle of the income spectrum, and moves them up at least a full level into what is described as the upper half. So military service has a way of elevating folks in terms of their exposure to the world. And we just want to be thankful today for each and every person out there, each and every family who has sent a member of their family into the U.S. military to stand guard on behalf of all of us and to promote liberty and justice for all. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Happy Veterans Day. Thank you to each and every one of you who has served. Connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com, where you can sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, and share today's show with someone new. Have a great weekend. God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.